Well, Earl, how are you?
Good. Glad to be here.
I'm so glad to be spending Saturday night talking about beauty. It's a wonderful way to end the evening, I think. Nothing too sad or dire, but something gorgioso we can talk about. I feel like you look at nature a lot through your computer screen, mapping it, looking at remote sensing data. Tell me about some beautiful anthropogenic places.
Yeah. So I've been trying to get a little bit out of my scientist box and get a little more into the culture box here. And we've both been just thinking, you know, how do we structure this discussion? We decided basically not to structure it. But we thought we'd start off with just talking about places that we feel are beautiful.
Right.
And so I'll start off with, I had two, I'll just go for three because another one occurred to me. And I like to do this kind of thinking spontaneously. If I think a lot about this, I think I'll get the answer wrong. I think it's really important not to think this one too much. What is beauty? What is the beautiful thing to you?
Right.
So when that question gets popped to me, the first thing I came up with was my farm. I have a piece of land in Western Maryland. It's a cattle farm that's basically overgrown. A lot of it's with invasives. I've actually started to dislike invasive plants because of how difficult it is to walk around that place now. But so that's one place. So that's obviously a place that has a huge human influence, very long one. Another one that popped into my mind was a village in China that I used to work in. It's not the most beautiful village I worked in, and this gets at what we also came up with as one of the reasons why we find these places beautiful. I found this place beautiful. I worked there for several years, on and off, and it was just this really pretty village that sloped down to the lake, also very ancient. Actually, one of the most interesting things about it was that it had added land over time as the lake filled in, and so they had really old land and really new land in the same village, which was kind of neat. But anyway, it was very, very beautiful village landscape, quiet and nice. And then the other place that occurred to me, and this one is probably gets into something a little bit more on the quote natural side, was I was thinking of Fiordland in New Zealand. I visited there one time. And that's a place that I would say is attractive, not just for the kind of the beautiful patterns of the different things, but in some ways the feeling, that presence of kind of quiet in nature left alone to some degree, even though maybe that's a fantasy. That was the fantasy that I got when I was there, and it felt good, and it was beautiful. So those are three types of places that I found beautiful.
Okay. So now my turn. All right, so the two places that I wrote down are, one isn't a place, one's a thing. One is the windmills, the modern wind power windmill, which I think can strike some people as very beautiful, other people as very ugly, depending on whether they see it as an unnatural blight on the landscape or whether they see it as I sort of tend to do, this sort of very modern, soaring potential way for us to have modern lives without totally destroying the planet, right? It's like, to me, they look like shining beacons of the future when we have no more coal plants and no more bad emissions and we've got everything all sorted out and the windmills are turning into the future. Another place is this ditch by my house in Columbia, Missouri. On the way to the park, there's a piece of land that's in between a horse paddock and a road, and it's probably, meters. Anyway, it's about the size of three or four people lying on end by about 10 people lying on end. And it is filled with invasive species and weeds and trash and occasionally water. There's some running water in there when it's wet, and birds, like tons of birds, love to hang out there of various species. And I really like it because it's incredibly diverse and nobody looks at it. I find it beautiful because I feel like it's my secret, that I see this piece of nature that nobody else sees. So I feel like everybody looks at the Grand Canyon, but only I look at this ditch.
Do you feel a sense of ownership of sorts?
I don't know if it's ownership or whether I just feel like, yeah, it's like a rarefied pleasure. It's like if you know of this secret nightclub and nobody else knows because it doesn't have a sign on the outside.
That's kind of sneaking into my when I think about those places that I just described have some of that going on.
The
too.
Ownership. Well, yeah, your farm, you actually own. The Chinese village, you spent time there, you invested in it personally.
And nobody ever would go there for tourism.
Right. So it's like a secret pleasure.
Exactly.
Right.
Like I was the one who could enjoy it the most in some ways.
I think all of this gets to the fact that there's a lot of more into the appreciation of beauty than just somehow colors and patterns and shapes. There's a lot of cultural baggage. Am I the only person to see this site? Have people come here? Take the visitor to Hawaii who looks at this gorgeous, lush landscape. I've heard many ecologists tell me that when they first arrived in Hawaii, they thought it was beautiful. And then they were educated to find out that most of the species they were looking at were non-natives, considered pests and weeds. And slowly the landscape turned ugly before their eyes because of this added information or knowledge. So it isn't just visual stimulus, right? It's like there's so much else going on.
So it's that relationship that you have, either just directly, personally, or culturally,
yeah,
to the place or the thing.
So well, that gets at the central question: is the Anthropocene beautiful? Now, there's probably many people in the world for whom this question would probably make no sense, because the idea that something is only beautiful if it hasn't been touched by humans is an idea of beauty that only applies to certain subcultures anyway, right? Like,
well, art.
What do you mean? Well, yeah,
well, art
sure.
It's touched, obviously.
But
people.
I mean, like, you know, there's a lot of people in the world who weren't brought up to prefer an old growth forest to a beautiful countryside image, you know. Now, I grew up in Seattle, and I was brought up that way, that sort of the most beautiful thing you could ever see was always the thing that was least touched by humans. That was the aesthetic that I more or less got handed. So.
Interesting. I don't think architects feel that way either.
Well, presumably not. Otherwise, they would be landscape. They'd be conservationists, right?
So it gets into this idea if people... It's interesting, too, because in a lot of realms, right, there's no question that humans can create beautiful things. I don't think anyone's going to ask that question.
Yeah.
Can humans create beautiful things? Of course, a lot
beautiful
of the things
tableware,
that we...
Beautiful tableware, beautiful buildings,
beautiful
art. The
iconic beautiful things, a lot of them are created by people.
Yeah.
Right? The Mona Lisa, let's say.
Right.
So...
I don't even know if people think that's beautiful anymore. I think they just think it's iconic. But, right, leave that aside.
You know what I mean? It's the idea that humans can't create beauty...
Yeah,
off
sure,
the table.
But okay,
that
all right,
true.
Fine. But like, what about just in the realm of landscape? You know,
right.
So
well, but let's face it. When you get into the human creation, where does it stop in the Anthropocene?
It doesn't.
It doesn't quite stop. So, if you look at the idea that humans can create beauty, and do, and we do this sometimes very intentionally, right? With there's gardening of and landscape architecture, which is a form of art. It's a design.
Definitely.
Art. It's a little more practical than perhaps building, making a painting as art, but it's still art.
Okay, well, let's talk about intentionality, because I think that might be key, So if you create a sculpture, it's beautiful, and if you mine the top of a mountain off, you're not trying to get that effect. Is that unintentional? What if you did that intentionally? Would that change it? I don't know. Like, does intentionality matter for beauty? Does it matter whether you did it on purpose?
Well, let's take one classic example of a kind of a created landscape, probably the most artificial form of nature in some ways, might, at least in the classical times, would be something like a classical Japanese or Chinese garden.
Right.
Where every last piece of that garden is designed and put into place. Often, like, the rocks are brought from faraway provinces at a time when that was really hard because there was just this extreme aesthetic that it had to be just so. And the fascinating thing about some of these, not all of them, some of them kind of are intentionally, have a little human and a little nature kind of imposing on each other that creates a kind of beauty. Some of them are intending to look natural.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, I swear, you look in there and you just feel like you're in a natural place.
Smaller, right?
Well, that's the key. You know, they've had to do that because they're used to living in dense populations for a very long time. That is the future of the Anthropocene. I often think that the Asians, already know how to live in the Anthropocene, and maybe the Europeans a little bit, and the Americans have no clue, and the Australians have no clue. Just because we never did it. We never lived in that dense, that crowded future.
I just think that maybe what's going on is that there is one particular strain of aesthetic snobbery which really privileges untouched landscapes, and that happens to be a particular strain that's common among sort of rich Westerners and thus gets sort of becomes dominant, but that this perhaps is not...
I wouldn't
actually that common.
Yeah. You know what, though? This is great. We're getting into it. We didn't even think of this, but this is a nice one. And I've had some funny experiences with this. So I wouldn't restrict it to rich Westerners, but I would restrict it to some degree to the true upper classes.
Okay, why?
And the first reserves of land, and some areas, you know, these are very old, and I bet they had these in early times too, are the hunting lands.
Sure.
And reserved for the king.
Right.
And that is the only place where people aren't allowed to take the game and all this stuff. It's just reserved for the ultra wealthy. And they appreciate it in part for the fact that nobody else can touch it. It's a sign of power.
To be able to stop somebody else from touching it.
Yes. And that beautiful aesthetic, right, might come from partly
the exercise,
you know,
of power.
A form of elitism about control. And a classic story about this was, and this is an interesting thing. So the Nature Conservancy has a lot of land all over the world. I believe they're the world's largest landholder.
Really?
Yes. And a lot of their stuff is in the human context. You can go visit and hang out. But a lot of it isn't.
Right.
And a good example is a lot of the islands that they possess. And the only people allowed onto those islands are the conservationists themselves and who? The richest people.
The rich donors.
That's correct. They get special junkets to go there. And to really, really paint the picture, one of the things, they've had a lot of problems with invasive, I don't know how to describe it, just wild pigs.
Non-native.
They're non-native pigs, and they tear everything up. And so The goal is to get rid of these pigs. Nothing better than going on the royal hunt. And they literally had even, some of these wealthy people would get to go hunt in these places, these preserves. They're the only people allowed to do anything like that. It was like a special privilege. So it's like almost like it comes full circle on this idea that the nature that you can't touch is the elite nature. It's
right.
The nature that's beyond us. It's a little bit like, you know, you're going to privilege that. You're going to pay for a tiger in India that you'll never see.
Right.
And that's precious, but your ditch is not good enough, you know.
It's, right.
It doesn't rank up there as worth 50 cents.
Well, so that's part of the reason I like these novel ecosystems, these weedy places, and why I find them beautiful is because I find them to be very sort of accessible, democratic spaces. Like, most of the really pretty places have already been claimed, and there's usually some government or some park ranger or some dude at the Nature Conservancy who's telling you what you can and cannot do there. But these kind of weedier places, nobody's paying any attention. There's nobody there except some like teenagers getting drunk on a Saturday night instead of finding out about beauty. And so that means that they're sort of democratic spaces in this way, and they're not possessed, maybe. Maybe. And that's interesting because I wrote down my list of ugly places, because we were going to talk about ugly places. One of them, I wrote Italy/Portola. So these are two places. I've seen this in Italy, and I've also seen this in the Portola neighborhood of San Francisco, where the dominant style of architecture is that your house comes all the way up to the sidewalk, and your garden is inside, and you can't see it from the street. If you want to see the garden, you have to knock at the door and know the owner and get entrance, and then there's some gorgeous inside garden. But from the street, these neighborhoods to me are very ugly because there's nothing green. Because all of the nature, all of the green has been privatized, and it's all hidden away. And so maybe we're circling around something here that...
Well, you're talking down about Baltimore now.
Yeah, well, no, Baltimore is like that, too.
We have row houses just perfectly like that.
Yeah, but do you have the pretty gardens hidden in the back?
Not quite as pretty as in San Francisco, perhaps. But
right.
No, we do have little gardens back there, although we did have a rat problem. We got to see in our garden.
You have a garden in your hidden
well,
in your back?
We moved when we had kids. But when I first moved to Baltimore, we lived in a regular row house, and there was a garden in the back, but it was very small. But it's true, and on the street, they were starting to plant trees again. They had them in the past, but there's a lot of neighborhoods there, and these are honestly the ones that are the most dangerous.
Yeah.
Generally, and the ones that, you know, you fear to tread are the ones without any street trees at all.
And I think that's true around the world. I think that you can generally predict the sort of level of people living below the poverty level with remote sensing by looking at how green neighborhoods are.
There's a question, though, with that one about whether there's a plus effect of wealth adds trees or whether poverty somehow takes them away. But there's certainly a relationship between, like, whether there's a cause and effect relationship or whether wealthier people intentionally move to places with more green.
Okay, so what have we said so far? We've said that you can't just look at a landscape and decide whether it's beautiful or ugly. There's so much more stuff built into that, like your preconceived notions about whether humanity makes things prettier or uglier, your position of power in relation to the landscape.
Your ability to exclude.
Your ability to exclude and control.
You can know that this place is outside of... Yeah, the control thing to some degree.
Yeah.
That's not the only form of beauty recognized here, but maybe it's the same kind that when people say, that place is untouched and therefore it is beautiful and precious, that's the kind of privileged nature.
Yeah, which
Whereas
is funny
there's also this other nature that we just kind of...
Because you hear people say that they like a piece of land because it's wild and uncontrolled, but simultaneously they're sort of reveling in their own ability to control it and keep it wild. Okay, I have some questions for you. Let's change the subject.
Sure.
When you take photographs on vacation of green areas, do you edit out the power lines and the fences with your camera so that you can only see the nature in the view screen?
If I could. Yeah. I was saying earlier, that's one of the things I really don't find very attractive is power lines and that sort of thing.
But you're Mr. Anthropocene. You're telling us this is a great thing, that humanity should exercise itself and solve problems and look to the future and not obsess about pristine wilderness.
Yeah. Well, I will say this, and maybe I'll get this straight from the beginning. All right. Is the Anthropocene always beautiful? No.
Yeah.
Can the Anthropocene be beautiful? Absolutely, yes. Can we move toward a thinking that, you know, one of the things that bothers me about power lines, I always feel like, and in Europe you don't have this so much, is that you could just bury them. You don't need to have, like, towers. It's a sense, it's like, we're in a hurry. We need to put these things up cheaply and effectively and just worry about the engineering. We're not going to care what it looks like.
Right.
We're just going to engineer this solution. And my feeling is, since we're permanent in the Anthropocene,
we should start behaving like we're permanent residents.
Yeah, get used to it. I mean, this is a long-term investment to put the power lines in. You know, we're going to be using power lines most likely for quite some time.
As soon as you say that, like 3 weeks from now, they'll be like, yeah, we figured out a way to move power with no lines.
Well, solar could
bury
be like
them
that.
All up.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? Like that form of human development where nobody is considering the fact that this is permanent. You got to live with this stuff forever. Imagine like this is the thing that's going to be here in 1,000 years. Are you going to be proud of this? You know, or are people going to want to get rid of it? You know, when I think, you know, we can create beautiful things, but we don't have to. We can certainly create any kind of thing. And when we're just thinking on the cheap, thinking short term, not caring that this is our environment, this is where you spend your life.
And your kid's life and their
exactly.
kid's life.
It's permanent. So paying attention to whether we think, I mean, maybe some people find, you know, power lines just beautiful. And in that case, well, we'd have an argument. You know,
right.
I want the power lines. I don't want them. But I think that the question is, you know, can we build a beautiful Anthropocene? I think yes. We
Do you
just
think
have
that
to
if you
come to agreements on that?
If you chase beauty, that you always end up in a more environmentally friendly position? Do you think that they are correlated?
Excellent question. You know, when I was at the Anthropocene meeting last year in London, I was just walking around and there was this building. It was the first time I saw one of those buildings that has a fully green wall.
Oh yeah.
A pretty tall one. They're getting more popular now, but that was the first time I ever saw one that was really well developed. And I thought, my first impression was, this is so awesome. You know, if all the cities were like this, man, think how good it would feel walking down the street. That green, I love that lush green feeling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just, I don't know if that's beauty or not. It just makes me feel good. So anyway, I see this thing and I'm thinking, oh, that's just so great. But I don't know. It's quite possible that is like the most environmentally harmful facade you could build. Like it might use up tons of water and, you know, create pollution and, you know, burn up energy. I have no idea. I didn't know, but my aesthetic feeling about it was that it was good. So I don't think there's a necessary relationship. I think if we want to have both, you have to actually pay attention to both.
My counterexample would be energy-efficient windows. So I've spent my whole life living in houses, the one I grew up in, the one I've lived in ever since, sort of hopping from house to house, and they all seem to have been built between about 1900 and about 1925. Maybe I just like the moldings they had during that era. But the windows are gorgeous. They have those rope and pulley windows that you open, and they have a counterweight. And I find those windows incredibly aesthetically appealing, but they're totally energy inefficient. And the energy efficient windows are made out of this like plastic, and they have this really tight seal and this like different locking mechanism. And I think they're ugly as sin.
Actually, that's my wife. She got these glass ones. We actually have to. We live in this historic neighborhood, and you have to install things that look historical. And so when we put, literally, we have like wood and glass.
So here you are. Your entire career is at the moment based around telling people that history should not be the shackles to forward progress in the environment. And yet you live in an environment where history is a shackle for your own day-to-day living.
Yeah.
Have you ever considered this irony?
Not too often, to be honest with you. But it's a real irony, though. Yeah, it's true. And actually, there's one thing I hate about it. I mean, it's got a slate roof. Mm-hmm. And slate roofs are terrible in the summer in Baltimore. I mean, I used to have my office up under the eaves, and it was like 150 degrees up there.
So not energy efficient.
No. Terrible. The worst kind of thing. But if we remove it, we'll actually have to pay a big fine and all this kind of stuff. So.
Okay, so this segues perfectly into my next question, which is how will our aesthetic sense change in the 100 years or 1,000 years with the Anthropocene? Will we come to love the look of energy-efficient windows and roofs?
I think it could be two things, right? One is just adapting aesthetically. Mm-hmm. The other is just getting better at making energy-efficient windows that we like.
That are pretty.
I mean, think about it. It's a market out there. People find these other ones, you know, both the same price. One of them people think is more beautiful than the other. Which one are you going to buy, you know?
What I want to know is whether we'll start to really appreciate messier things, right? Because I think that messier things are usually more diverse, and less messy things are usually less diverse. So if we really want to produce more diversity in our cities and our suburbs, maybe there'll be fewer suburbs in the future if we play our cards right. We'll want messier lawns and messier garden beds and messier, and like paint, you know, if you don't repaint your house every 5 years, you save a lot of resources and energy and so on. I mean, is it possible to love mess more in the future, do you think?
Well, I already do. Yeah, that's another issue with me and my wife, right, is I could never mow. I mean, if that lawn just grew up with the most horrible weeds, I'd be happy. You know, I don't really care what grows there, but she does. She wants it to be mowed.
Why does she want it to be mowed?
I think it's partly the neighbors would complain, and they would complain, like their lawns are mowed.
So it's a cultural thing. Everybody has to change at the same
Swiss.
Time.
She likes things
she's
to be neat.
Half Swiss.
I don't know. She likes things to be neat. I think a lot of. I mean, there's people that like neat things and people that like messy things. And I don't think that the Anthropocene has to be messy or neat. It can be, you know, a mix of both. We can have.
I think it has to be
more
messy.
Than one kind of.
I don't think it can be too neat. I think neat is too expensive energetically and too undiverse. Give me an example of a way you could have a neater solution that would be better environmentally.
Well, in Baltimore, some people are famous for putting gravel over the yards and not having anything growing there. Now, that's not a very pleasant solution, but
and
it's a little bit like beauty, right? It's in the eye of the beholder. It's in the context too. Like when you have the thing in the museum and it's held up, you know, and you're looking at it and in awe of its, you know, creative beauty. You're getting one kind of beauty there. And when you're at a place that's untouched, in theory, you're going to get another kind of feeling about it because of the context in which it is. And if you're in something in between that can also be extraordinarily beautiful, people will pay the big bucks, right, to go to stay in the villa in Tuscany in the ancient Italian-Roman landscape, right? That's beautiful, but it's completely anthropogenic. It's messy. But, you know, there's also some neat places people like. Modernism can be kind of neat. And you know, I don't think we...
Rows of crops and greenhouses. I'm trying to think of things that have a lot of straight lines and are very tidy. And they don't... I mean, I'm just struggling to find one that's, like, super green or diverse.
Well, maybe that's a challenge for the architects is to be modernist and fully green. I mean, I think that's something they always talk about. But, you know, it is somewhat of a challenge, I think.
All right. What else we got here?
Is nuclear waste beautiful? How about, let's try that one. Suggestion from the audience.
That would be a tough one for me. I mean, first of all,
what's that?
Rice terraces.
Rice terraces. Oh, Earl can talk about that.
Well, yeah, the village I was describing has some terracing. Although most of it's just, it's farmed hillsides, though. And yeah, I think most people would find that village pretty beautiful. Just like if you find a southern France village beautiful, you'd find it beautiful. It's, you know, it's
nuclear waste is an interesting one because I have almost no idea what it looks like by itself, not in containers, right? Like I don't have a good visual image for that, and maybe that's surprising given how often environmentalists have historically used ugliness to motivate environmental concern by showing pictures or by creating imaginary pictures in their listeners' minds about the ugliness that could ensue if certain things take place or are not stopped. Seems like I should have a very clear image of nuclear waste, but I don't.
Well, fortunately, we don't spend too much time in contact with it.
Yeah, right. But I mean, certainly mountaintop removal mining, there's a lot of people who are very much against that, and that's, I think, the aesthetic destruction there is a huge part of why people are willing to be so activist against that particular practice. Mining that happens mostly underground or far away maybe doesn't have as much activist concern.
Yeah. I think it's very possible for humans to create things that we find very ugly. Remember, and the other thing we talked about earlier about the eye of the beholder is, what if there is no eye of the beholder? Is there any beauty then? Us actually being there to appreciate it, and our ability, cultural, individual, however it emerges, to appreciate beauty is ours. And even if other species have it, it's different than ours, for sure. I'm sure of that. You know, they have a different appreciation if they have any. So our beauty, when we ask the question, is the Anthropocene beautiful, and we ask it as humans, right, we're going to have to answer it as humans. And that, you know, in some ways is up to us, you know, how we're going to appreciate things. Some of it can't be decided. Some of it is either culturally or personal. I don't know which is which, right? If you take, there was a time when people thought of big forests as scary, terrible places, and
yeah,
the best thing you could possibly do with them was burn them down and build a farm. And that was a beautiful thing.
Right.
A farm could sustain your family, those rows of crops. There was a beauty there, too. And then we changed the aesthetic, and now it's like the best thing you could do would be to save those beautiful old trees. And that's the world we live in now, I think, a world where the nature that hasn't been converted into use is scarce.
Scarce, right.
And I think that's part of the reason why we're able to appreciate it more. And I hope that will continue to accelerate. I think it is good to appreciate those places for their rarity and to try and do what we can to keep as much of that as we can, because they are beautiful. There's no question, I think, in my mind, whether they're beautiful or not.
Mm-hmm.
And they're valuable. But that doesn't mean, just like if the only beautiful thing is the untouched thing, that the Mona Lisa is no longer beautiful, right? Our human creations can't be beautiful.
Right.
I mean, that seems also equally silly. So we can do both. And absolutely we can create ugliness. Like when mountaintop removal, I've seen some of it, it is pretty ugly. Now, you come back 1,000 years, you may not be able to tell. That's the reality of really ancient anthropogenic changes, is that they become the new nature in such a way that you really have no reference. When you see these places, China is a good example of this, where you can go visit, you know, places that it's almost impossible to imagine what they were like as a virgin forest. They've been, you know, farmed for thousands of years, and people consider them beautiful. You know, ancient rice terraces, a good example. People will fly to those places to appreciate their beauty. Completely anthropogenic. They replaced probably a tropical rainforest.
Mm-hmm.
Yet they can be considered beautiful because you're not in the act of destruction. You're only in the act of sustaining something.
I think that how recent a change occurred clearly affects people's perception of its beauty. Some change to the landscape that happened last week is much more likely to be perceived as ugly than a change to the landscape that happened a generation ago. I think that's pretty clear. We talked about trash and how, like, a Marlboro pack in the undergrowth looks pretty ugly to pretty much everyone, but an old clay pipe from 200 years ago found in the undergrowth strikes us as a treasure, something interesting, exciting.
We're finding ruins in the forest.
Right.
You know, that's kind of, it almost like it adds a kind of beauty to discover the ruins in the forest.
The old wall.
Yeah, like the Smoky Mountains are a great example. You know, the trees grow really fast there. It's very warm and moist.
Yeah, my impression is the Smoky Mountains were just a bunch of farms
recently. They were all a bunch of farms, and actually there was they built a big dam over there, and there was all these camps. And they pretty much just left the camps when they made the park out of it, and they just decayed. And so you walk through some of these areas, and the trees are huge. I mean, there are, you know, 3-4 people around. They're really big. And then you kind of accidentally come up to, like, you know, a pile of garbage and some foundations of buildings and stuff like that. It's, you know, it's only, what, 90 years
so
old?
So what's, yeah, what's the cutoff? Is it, it's ugly, ugly. As you go back in time, it continues to be ugly until you hit your own childhood or the day before you were born or one generation. How far back do you go before the ugly turns into a beautiful treasure?
Sounds like a good research project for a student.
Right, because I think it's an empirical question, right? Like, there's no mystical thing there. We could actually just ask people.
It probably depends a lot on the culture, though.
Yeah.
I mean,
older cultures, it would require longer elapsing of time.
That's a hypothesis.
And then, so in Seattle, where I'm from, which is one of the newest cities, it's probably like something from 1976. It's probably pretty awesome and old and worth putting in a museum.
Yeah. I want to get a little further into the Anthropocene beautiful thing. What about like the clear and obvious constructions? You know, something like a village, you know, nobody went in there to build a beautiful village. They just kind of emerged out of all these people farming and and adapting over the long term to the conditions. So, but there are examples where, you know, you literally build stuff. And like, let's just say that, you know, someone builds a new city like they do in China now. They, you'll actually plan and build a whole city.
Right.
Can that city be beautiful?
I don't see why not.
If we did this to the whole planet?
Just Shenzhen wall to wall?
Well, it's a possibility. It's an imagination that, you know.
Well, scale
it's
affects beauty.
That's kind of the extreme idea.
Yeah, but it's a good, I mean, scale affects beauty, right? So, I mean, things that have an appropriate scale are more beautiful and harmonious than people who, things that are out of scale or seem grotesquely large. Yes? No?
Maybe. Is there, getting back to that scarcity thing?
Yeah.
I mean, there wouldn't be anything scarce. I mean, everything would be more than scarce. It would be gone. And
right.
So there, you'd only be able to, you'd appreciate the nuances within the city. My guess is that humans would adapt we adapt to some degree everything according to our situation, right?
Shifting baselines.
Yeah, exactly. Like what, I'll give you an example. If we were here, you know, 10,000 years ago, you know, the hunter-gatherers here would have looked around and, you know, they would have found the forest beautiful perhaps, or certain areas where there were good things to harvest were good, or good game grounds or whatever. That's what they would have seen as beautiful perhaps. They would appreciate, had that sensibility. And then the farmers came and started to change it. My guess is that the probably the hunter-gatherers, and it's now the theory, the best evidence says that, you know, the farmers kind of encroached on the hunter-gatherers. It wasn't like the hunter-gatherers turned into farmers all over Europe.
Huh.
Let's just take that scenario. So the farmers come in, and the hunter-gatherers are still there.
Mm-hmm.
And the farmers are clearing some of the land and converting it into these engineered ecosystems for agriculture. What do they think about that landscape? My guess is they're horrified.
The hunter-gatherers?
Yeah, they see the agricultural landscape as like a disaster because it's the end of their lifestyle.
Right.
It goes against their
It eats
life.
Up their resources as
yeah.
well, I mean, on a practical level.
And so their aesthetic that's built out of their lifestyle conflicts with this other aesthetic built out of another lifestyle. Now we have Berlin here, and, you know, there's no farming here. But farming here, if there was an agricultural landscape, say, right in the city, it might be considered kind of attractive and somewhat beautiful because
Definitely.
It would be so much less developed than the areas that are...
But more developed things are not always less beautiful, for
True.
Sure.
True.
I'm thinking about this. Why does it strike me as sad that we could get used to anything? Like, right, so the tiger goes extinct, vast areas of land are converted to human uses. We get used to that. Our aesthetic sense changes. Suddenly we're like, oh, a house sparrow, how beautiful. Why does that make me sad?
It doesn't make me sad, but it makes me, it's the most deep angst.
Why?
Because that is our predicament, is when you... This is something that was posed. A friend of mine, professor, he went to a talk by a professor of physics who was talking about what will happen if we are able to achieve nuclear fusion and achieve essentially...
Free energy
extremely
forever.
Extremely cheap energy, right.
Right.
That doesn't create a whole lot of pollution. It appears, and now there's always a dark side to these things, but let's just say that what he was saying was true, that we will suddenly have all the energy we could use, and it won't cost us hardly anything. It'll just be too cheap to meter, as they've said.
Mm-hmm.
So then we can change anything, and essentially we don't need to burn fossil fuels and change the climate.
Right.
We don't need to. We can grow all of our food in a building if we want, with enough energy.
Massive
we could do whatever you want.
Sunlight.
You don't
massive
have to
lamps.
Use up. You could not have any more farming. We could just have all the wild forests, let them come back. We could do almost anything. What will we do? What will we do if the environment isn't really a problem? You know what I mean? Like, we can kind of master it.
I don't know what I would do. I'd have to get a new job, that's for one thing.
Because now we have all these compromises, right? If you want a lot of energy right now, you're gonna burn a lot of fossil fuel and you're gonna create a lot of global warming, and that's gonna be a problem.
Right.
And so we're faced with that kind of conundrum, is that we can do those things, but we pay for them. Right. But what if we didn't have to pay for that? What if we could just do whatever? Would we do something that
would we just retreat into massive cities and let the earth go wild?
It's hard to say what we would do. We don't really know, but it seems that and this is where science fiction has been useful to me, at least. Philip K. Dick, who's become very popular now, he has a way of looking at the future that is both, essentially it's techno-darkness in a sense. He's not saying that technology becomes evil. It's just that the only thing that really changes with us is that we have more capabilities all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that we have more morality,
right,
more aesthetics, more humanity. It just means that we have more ability. That's all that we get more of.
So when you look
at the future, we do the same things that we do now that we don't like, but we do them much more powerfully. Right?
You mean like
if somebody wants to, like, this part of Berlin, we don't like it. Let's plant redwoods and make it, look like anything. You can make anything with this kind of power. It's almost like that encourages things not to be beautiful. Because you don't have to appreciate things. You can just do whatever you want. In some ways, like being able to step back from that thing out there, the thing you're experiencing, the environment, and be able to say, that's just the way it is. And appreciate it for that, just for being itself, not for what we do to create it, but just appreciate it for what it is. I'm not so sure that's a strongly developed feature of humanity. Do you know what I mean? We like to change things for the better. And sometimes it is for the better and it's good. But sometimes there's just this inevitable changing things for the better that's not for the better.
So I'm processing all this. I think you're right that we have an incredible urge to fiddle with things. I've said that before. And it's absolutely the case that our fiddling is not always for the best.
Oh, no question.
I think we're facing that situation now. But I'm not sure it's true that we don't have the ability to aesthetically appreciate some things that happen outside of our control or by accident or because we just left them alone.
Does it drive society? I'm sure we can appreciate it, and probably everybody can in some way. But when you make the decisions that matter about changing the world, is that what comes into play? The feeling that the humbleness to say, it's better without touching it. Just let it go. Is that what comes flooding in, or is it more like, I want that better thing.
Yeah.
I want something more. It's not saying that we're bad. It's just, there's just a tendency
just
a little
childish.
Bit more this way than that way. Maybe that's it. Maybe we're not so good at appreciating what we have and trying to go for something that we don't. And, there are a lot of things that need to be improved about the way we live on Earth, a lot of us enjoy, pretty much anything we want, but, a lot of people don't. And
right.
That still strikes me as, the big problem, really, is that. Not
inequity.
Yeah. And it's not like everyone should be equal, but the idea that, people
I think it is like everybody should be equal.
Well, that's been tried, and it's not very good.
Okay, fine. All right, let's do some rapid fire beauty. Okay. All right, so tell me, what's the most beautiful thing you saw this week?
This week? Ooh. I don't catalog these things, I got to say.
Wash over you.
Well, when we started, just saying, let's think of a few beautiful things that are...
You struggled?
A little bit, because, like I said, I don't catalog it. And I think there is I do see something wrong with this, which is that the whole, by finding one thing beautiful, we find another not beautiful. There is a tendency by labeling beauty, saying this is beautiful, that's beautiful, that's beautiful, then the other things can't be, right? Because you're kind of restricting the beauty. By labeling it, you're doing that. And it's almost like it's better not to do that and rather to just feel the beauty when you get it rather than, make a list and decide, these things are beautiful and these are not. So I don't have a good answer to that. I probably found the most beautiful. This building, I think, is kind of cool.
This building we're in?
Yeah, it dawned on me. I thought it was interesting. I appreciated it. I appreciated that it was the intentionality of it, what they were trying to do with it. And I never would have in the past. I had a girlfriend who was an architect at one point, and she she managed to get me to understand architecture a little bit. You know, what the point is of architecture, the design and beauty and functionality, how that creation can be beautiful.
It snowed today. That was pretty beautiful.
Yeah, it's cold, wet. I'm not a cold weather person so much. If it didn't snow, I would be fine. But you can always go to places where it doesn't snow.
All right, let's sum up what we've covered today. Is the Anthropocene beautiful? Yes, but it's also ugly. And I think that's unsurprising, given that it's pretty much all we have at this point. So it's got to contain both beauty and ugliness. What makes things particularly beautiful? Being on purpose makes things beautiful. Being on accident makes things beautiful. Being halfway in between wild and human-dominated tends to be a particularly beautiful space. That's where your farm is, and that's where your Chinese villages are, and that's where my ditch is.
But I find some places that people consider wild to be beautiful, too. No question.
Yeah.
Here's a question that we talked about a little bit earlier that we definitely want to cover this, which is, should we have an aesthetic for the Anthropocene? Should we kind of intentionally think up or try to create a kind of aesthetic that will help us
right.
in the Anthropocene, will make a better Anthropocene? And there's the two sides of that, right? There's the one side is the adaptation part, like, oh, well, we destroyed everything, so let's make it seem beautiful.
Right.
That's the kind of the bad way to do it in a way. It's like
right.
not, that'll be an adaptation, yes, but it's not really plan A. You know, plan A is ideally, I guess, is to, the aesthetic should be that if it's, I guess, beautiful already, leave it alone, and if it's not beautiful enough, maybe we can do something about it.
I don't know if that should be it.
I don't know either, but I'm throwing it out there.
I think that it is very tempting to try to tweak the aesthetics that are very expensive with natural resources, such that people don't spend a lot of time operating leaf blowers and using lots of herbicides on their lawns and those kinds of things. I do find it very tempting to try to sort of intentionally loosen up people's aesthetics and get them more interested in dirtier things and things that are less fossil fuel expensive. And so, sure, yeah, I mean, if there's some sort of propaganda campaign or psyops to try to get people more interested in that aesthetic, I might be interested in that. I don't know what the ethics are of trying to change people's aesthetics.
It's been tried. It's hard to do, I think, to change aesthetics intentionally. I mean, if you could do that, probably somebody would have a company doing it and you could pay them to do it for you.
I'm sure that they're doing it right now. In fact, they're telling us that the new aesthetic is we all need like purple shoelaces, $9.99
a pair. You need something you don't yet have.
Yeah, exactly.
I
mean, there is a whole industry devoted to this kind of trying to push our aesthetics to a place where we'll spend money on their products. So I think that's out there.
And arguably, you got the same thing with people and nature appreciation. And I don't think that's a bad thing. You know, in some cases, you know, when you get these, you know, letters from World Wildlife that have, you know, save the this or save the that.
Yeah.
They are trying to, you know, give you a moral feeling and an aesthetic feeling, too, that, you know, these things are worth protecting and you should help protect them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in some ways, you know, this is necessary. You know, for people who don't actually get exposed otherwise, maybe it's a very good thing that somebody takes the initiative to try to expose people to the places that they don't see. But maybe the same is true of the things right under our feet, right? Like your book.
Yeah, I'd like to, we should wrap it up, but there is an aesthetic of the glossy, super glossy, high gloss nature documentary that I object to strenuously. Planet Earth being my favorite example.
I love
hate.
The fact, yeah, it's like rotate the camera like this far and you see like all the guys watching them.
Yeah, and the dirty snow and
watching.
The fence. I mean,
yeah,
these
classic.
Nature documentaries are so precisely edited and presented to create the image of this gorgeous, beautiful.
It's fake Earth.
It's fake Earth that's untouched and there's no fences and there's no power lines, there's no vehicle tracks, there's
right.
no guys holding the reflector. You know, there's no
sense. It's as artificial
sense.
As the Mona
it's
Lisa.
It's incredibly artificial.
It is. It's a cultural creation.
And it's very popular. And I think that it's responsible, partially responsible, for people being totally unable to then see the trees in their front yard as beautiful, the little birds hopping around outside the pizza parlor is beautiful. I mean, this kind of, you know, there has been long been research to support the kind of common sense notion that if you watch a lot of porn, you'll stop finding your wife beautiful. And that's what's happening with nature. If you watch a lot of nature porn, you will stop finding your garden and your street beautiful. And it's a damn shame, and I hate it.
Interesting. So we should stop... fetishizing the wild beauty.
Yes, absolutely. We should. There should be, you know, we should just turn off planet Earth and take a deep breath and go for a walk.
I like that. That'd be an excellent line to close on.
I think it might. Shall we let them all go out into the snow and appreciate the beauty
for a glass
of Berlin?
Of wine, right?
Yes, that's something that's truly beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you very much.